Hey, Bible nerds, this is Dr. Manny Arango, and I'm your host for the Bible Department podcast powered by Arma. This podcast follows a Bible reading plan we created to help you read the entire Bible in a year. You can head to the show notes or thebibledepartment.com to download our reading plan and join the journey. Family, welcome to day 158. We're making our way through 2 Samuel today. We've got 2 Samuel chapter 4, 5. 6, 7. We got 4 chapters today. Hey, if you've already done the reading, then everything that I'm going to say in this episode is going to make perfect sense. If you have not done the reading, then you may be a little lost. So you may want to stop the video, stop the audio, and go do the reading. Day 158, 2 Samuel, action-packed book of the Bible. Like always, I'm going to give you some context clues. I'm going to give you some nerdy nuggets, and I'm going to give you some timeless truths. We're actually going to backtrack just a little bit, and I'm going to give you some nerdy nuggets that I meant to actually give you yesterday, but just, you know, didn't have all the time in the world. First thing, a nerdy nugget from yesterday, is that raiding and plundering battle sites was very normal and a very, very common practice in the ancient world, okay? So when two armies battled each other, that meant that there were clothes, weapons, swords, and things like crowns. So if you are wondering, okay, this Amalekite that David kills, how does this Amalekite have Saul's crown? Well, it's because once all the fighting is over, and once it's just a field or mountain slope or mountainside of dead bodies, people are going to come and they're going to plunder and raid. This is normal. People who are living around the area are going to get shoes and clothes and coins and swords and spears and weapons and, yes, crowns. So this Amalekite is the First Samuel tells us that Saul kills himself, and his armor bearer won't even kill him, won't even help him die. So his armor bearer kills himself as well. So this Amalekite probably is just out there raiding shortly after, like same day or the next day, and realizes, oh gosh, this is Saul, and this is crown. Let me go bring it to David, win some points with the new regime. Little does he know that David has an unfathomable sense of loyalty to Saul and Jonathan and their home, their house, like their lineage, their family. So that's number one. If you're just wondering, wait a second, if this guy's lying, how does he have Saul's crown? Well, he has Saul's crown because it's normal to go plunder and raid a battlefield. Okay, number two. The other thing that you may have noticed, or maybe you didn't notice, is from chapter 2 to chapter 3, David picks up 4 more wives. Now, this is not good, and the text doesn't have to tell us that this isn't good. We know it's not good. We know it's not good because foreign kings are going to accumulate wives because they're going to use wives to form political alliances. And God does not say that this is a good thing. Okay. It's a lack of faith. And this is quintessential secular king activity. And the king of Israel is not supposed to act like a secular king. He's supposed to act like a godly king, supposed to be set apart. So I just want you to notice, you're going to begin to see the list of wives grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Okay. Next, David's loyalty towards Saul's family is absolutely radical in every way. So now for today's reading, here's the context. Okay. This entire chunk, chapter 4, 5, 6, and 7, is all about the ascent of David and the establishing of his rule over Israel. So in yesterday's reading, David became king just over Judah, over one tribe. Well, in the chunk of reading that we have today, he is going to become king over all of Israel. And the big win here is that he's going to finally take Jerusalem. Okay? Jerusalem has been under foreign control this entire time. Many of us, we almost know the land of Israel by the city of Jerusalem. And it's actually very, very fascinating how David is going to take control of the city of Jerusalem. For those of you who don't know, Jerusalem It has three mountain ranges and two valleys, and it looks like a W. So anytime you want to kind of see how Jerusalem looks, like there's just these three valleys, three mountains that form two valleys that make up Jerusalem. To make a long story short, because of these three valleys, sorry, it's the other way around. It's three valleys and two mountain ranges, sorry, that makes it look like a W. It means that the Gihon Spring makes Jerusalem an oasis, okay? And the Jebusites had put up walls, and so they're able to take the city because they're able to, like, crawl under the city's sewer system, essentially. It's actually insanely genius. One thing that I really, really want to point out is chapter 6, okay? Once Jerusalem is settled, once David is the king over a united Israel, we're going to begin to move the Ark of the Covenant, which is great. But the only issue is that they're moving it on a cart. The Ark is not supposed to be moved on a cart. They're doing something based on convenience. Okay, this is our nerdy nugget for the day. The Ark was supposed to be placed on the shoulders of the Levitical priests and moved physically because the weight of God's glory was actually something that was supposed to physically rest on your shoulders. They're putting it on a cart because this box is heavy. But the word for heavy and the word for glory are the same word in Hebrew. Worship is a heavy thing. It's actually why praise music is so important in church. If all we do is sing worship music, worship is kind of heavy, okay? You can start to realize people can get depressed and all you do is worship. You actually need celebration. You need praise. And I know that praise music can seem, I don't know, there's nothing biblical about it. I don't know why people think this, that like worship music is just more spiritual or more mature. I remember when I was a youth pastor, you know, we would always make sure that we had a good balance of praise and worship. Praise isn't just fast songs. Worship isn't just slow songs. It's actually, it has more to do with the direction of the music. As someone who comes from a Black church tradition, this is actually one of the things that I love about Black church, is that praise requires other people. So that's why praise typically happens with a choir, because we are all praising God together. So praise is not something you can do as an individual. Worship, you can worship as an individual person. You can worship as a soul, individual unit. You can just worship the Lord, because worship is very, very vertical in nature. But praise is very horizontal. We are all, like, I could praise my wife to you. I could tell you all these amazing things about my wife. So praise is very, very horizontal. And I think over the last 15, 20 years, worship has dominated in church over praise. And that I can see a direct correlation between that and depression and anxiety, because worship's heavy. It is. It's supposed to be heavy. We're supposed to feel the weight of the glory or the kabod of God. And so instead of dealing with the weight, they put the ark on a cart. Well, I really want to like point this out, because it says this, verse 5, chapter 6. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, okay, with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. So you're not supposed to touch the ark. You're supposed to put poles through the loops, and you're supposed to carry it on your shoulders. But because they are doing something improperly, they create an unsafe spiritual scenario for everybody. And Uzzah then thinks he can assist God. God cannot be assisted. And God kills him. Okay, the holiness of God is not something that can be touched by the sinfulness of humans. And so I want us to focus on this. Okay, it's chapter 6. I want us to focus on this because although there is singing and celebrating, there is not worship. Because in order for there to be worship, there has to be obedience. Obedience. And they are celebrating the presence of God in a way that God has not instructed them to celebrate his presence. And although there is great celebration, that does not mean that there is worship, because worship requires obedience. This is a lot like Samuel saying to Saul, hey, obedience is better than sacrifice. Just because you sacrificed animals to the Lord does not mean that there's worship, because worship requires obedience. I cannot disobey God, but think that the extravagance of what I'm offering him is going to distract him from the fact that I'm disobeying him. So they finally get it right. For anyone who struggles with this, then David is struggling as well. Look at verse 8. David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. But then the ark stays at a random dude's house for 3 months. Okay. Now King David was told, hey, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom, this is verse 12, and everything he has because of the ark of God. So David went to bring up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, they sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Okay, so now David's dancing again, and we get this famous line where his wife, Saul's daughter, says, like, why have you danced before all these servant girls? And David's got this iconic line. It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. That's an iconic moment, okay? And then we're going to get a moment that is a bit interesting in chapter 7. David now had built himself a house, a palace, and wants to build God a house. Now, God is not a fan of this idea, okay? And I know you may have never heard this before. There are a lot of scholars who would suggest that God never really gives a thumbs up or an approval on the building of the temple. That God's idea for how he was going to dwell with his people was confined to a tabernacle, and that God was happy to dwell in a tent so that no tribe could have a monopoly on a permanent location of God's presence. So as long as you have a tent, the tent moves around, and every tribe can have access to the tent because a tent is mobile, okay? The moment you put a physical location that's permanent, buildings cannot move. Tents can move. Buildings cannot move. Now that there's a permanent location, so the only difference between the tabernacle and the temple is that the tabernacle is a mobile tent. The temple is built with the same dimensions, has all the same furnishings, but it's a permanent building. Once there's a permanent building in Jerusalem, now all the tribes have to migrate or have to make pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which begins to elevate the tribe of Judah, because Jerusalem is in the tribe of Judah. And this is going to become a point of tension between the northern tribes and the southern tribes, and is going to lead to the division between Judah and Israel. Okay. Once we get past Solomon, the nation is going to split again, and it's going to stay split all the way up until exile. So there are a lot of scholars who firmly believe making the temple a permanent building and putting it in Jerusalem is really a political move. And David is doing this not because he loves the Lord, but because he wants Jerusalem to have a political centrality. He wants to be able to control the worship of Yahweh. And there's a lot of evidence for this. I haven't made up my mind one way or the other, but you can see in God's response. God's response is, I'm good, bro. I really don't need a house. And now God's response to David is going to be, but I'll establish your house. And house here is used as a double entendre. I'll establish your house, which means I'll establish your dynasty, that your family will be the family through which Jesus is going to come. So now God now establishes an unconditional covenant with David, that David will always have an heir on the throne. And that is going to be fulfilled through the person of Jesus Christ. Now, when Nathan prophesies to David, this is chapter 7. This is God's response to not wanting a temple built. He says in verse 11b, going into verse 12, the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. So the word house is getting used as a double entendre. Instead of a physical building, now God is saying, I'm going to establish a dynasty for you, a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. Now, you could assume that he's talking about Solomon, because that's going to be the David's son who's going to take over as king. He is the one who will build a house for my name. And Solomon then builds a temple. However, if you keep reading, you begin to realize, I think he's talking about Jesus, actually. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 14, I will be his father and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. This doesn't sound like something that was fulfilled in Solomon's lifetime, okay? This sounds like the crucifixion. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Nathan reported to David all the words of this entire revelation. So, there's a lot of scholars who really do believe God never really gives a final thumbs up on the building of a temple, that is David and his son Solomon's idea, that is not God's idea. So that the temple is a bit of a concession. It's not like God is saying, I hate it, but God definitely didn't. God didn't initiate the idea or the concept for a physical temple. And you can make a massively strong argument that politically would actually make more sense for the unity of the nation of Israel for no one tribe to have a monopoly on a house of worship or on the presence of God. I know this is very, very granular, very, very nerdy, but essentially, like when Jesus talks to the woman at the well and she has questions about where should we worship, and the Samaritans worship here, but the Jews worship in Jerusalem at the temple. That all becomes a problem because the Samaritans don't have access to the temple that is in Jerusalem. So there's a bunch of geography and geopolitics that are actually at work that start here with David. And there's a lot of scholars who just believe David's motives here are political. And God can see that. God can't be fooled. And so God never says that a temple is a good idea. But God allows it, but God doesn't ever actually approve of it. That's which leads us into our timeless truth. I think that's actually a great segue. Just because God allows something does not mean that God approves something. That is a timeless truth. You could change God's answer. That doesn't mean you've changed God's mind. So be very, very careful. It may be true that God has said yes, but I think we all need to really ask ourselves some hard questions when God says yes. What tone did he say yes in? Did he say, yeah, I think that's a great idea? Or did he say, all right, go for it? You know, those are worlds apart. And I would say I lean towards the perspective that don't think that the temple was God's idea. I do think it was a concession. I think it's something that he allowed, but I don't think that it is something that he approved of, but I think it's something that he allowed. And that's our timeless truth for the day. All right. Tomorrow is day 159. We've got 2 Samuel chapter 8 through 10. I'll be right here. If you got a streak going, I'm proud of you. Keep that streak going. If you don't got a streak going, well, today's a good day to start one. All you got to do is just keep racking up days where you don't miss. And if you didn't miss today, all you got to do is don't miss tomorrow. And then we got to get this streak going because the Bible is good for you. Hey, guys, I love you so much. I'm proud of you. I'll see you right here tomorrow. Peace.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Bible Department podcast. If this episode was helpful, it would mean the world to me if you'd give us a follow, rate and review the show, and don't forget to share. You can learn more about the show at thebibledepartment.com and find us on Instagram at the Bible Department. If you want to dive deeper into the Bible, you can get free access to our library of courses at thebibledepartment.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow. What if I told you that what you're learning in this video was just the tip of the iceberg? The Bible Department is actually powered by Arma. What is Arma? I'm so glad you asked. Arma is an online subscription-based platform that we designed to help people, everyday people, learn the Bible for themselves. We started Arma so that anybody, anywhere, could have access to trustworthy and entertaining Bible and theology content. In addition to this podcast, we have over 60 courses on individual books of the Bible, on theology topics, and on some hot topics like homosexuality, tithing, and women in ministry. But really, Arma is a community of people that I've gotten to know, a community where thousands of people are currently finding family, asking questions, and nerding out on the Bible together. If you want a community to read the Bible with you this year, or if you want to dive into some deeper theological content, or if you want more exclusive access to me and the entire Arma team, how about you go to thebibledepartment.com. I'll be sure to post the link in the description of this video. Let's make this your year to become a Bible nerd.